pervert a handbook passage to me, okay?
Welcome to a Lorehounds and Properly Howard joint production covering Severance on Apple TV Plus, Season 2, Episode 7, Chakai Bardo. I'm John. With me today, he recycles his urine as drinking water, David.
I am a soldier for Kier.
He belayed his first couloir in middle school, Steve.
So true.
And his doctoral thesis was titled All Quiet on the Western Blunt, Anthony.
Give me my A now.
Anthony, have you, well, I don't know in your particular line of work, but have you had to field many of the student papers about how legalization, well, you know, in its past now with marijuana, but the whole legalization of marijuana?
Most of my papers are written by AI and receive Fs.
So most, really?
it's become a sort of an overnight sensation. Not much to do with All Quiet on the Western Front. That's a little bit overstated, but it's a dramatic shift. It's a dramatic shift. And, you know, it's fine. You know, most professors will design their syllabus using AI, and the students will write their papers using AI, and then the professors will grade using AI.
Exactly.
And we all continue to, you know, get pushed through the conveyor belt, and everyone gets what they want in the end.
And soon the AIs will just talk to each other, and you won't even have to do any work.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
That's right. That's right. Well, let's get that universal basic income going before we get to that point. So anyway, David, can you tell people quick housekeeping?
Just absolutely.
We've done it many times now, but you, some people still need to hear.
We're still getting, still people are subscribing to the season's pass. So
true.
We have more episodes in the pipeline. So if you do want to get ad-free versions without a subscription, you can just spend $5 and get a season pass. There's a link in the show notes, or you could support the whole network by becoming a regular subscriber on Patreon or Supercast. In this,
you can hear me yell about Eraserhead. I did that a lot.
Today. Yeah, that was a good one.
I missed the part about the season pass. Could you say that again?
You know, I just want to really reinforce it multiple times for people.
I know, so our listeners love to hear that.
They do. They love to hear my mouth noises as well. I'm doing it as well.
Have you heard about our season pass, though?
In our supply closet episodes, we've had conversations with Mark and Nicole from Nevermind the Music. Anthony had a lovely conversation with Jason Eberl. Is it Eberl or Eberl?
I always say Eberl. Yeah.
Philosopher. I always feel so bad because I mispronounce Eberl. His name. But he's an ethicist and philosopher and is a student of the sci-fi genre. And I just had a conversation with Ian and Aisha. Ian from the Captain's Pod and Cinema Sins, and Aisha from every single sci-fi film ever. That was a lovely conversation. So all of those are available in the supply closet. If you want to head to the Discord for real-time chat about the show, there's a link in the show notes, or you can send us email, severance@thelorehounds.com. Our hand of the pod, Nancy, will be glad to collate your submissions. And please remember to like, rate, and review the podcast.
Well, here we are, folks. Season 2, Episode 7. Anthony, why don't you start us off with your hot takes?
Yeah, I think we've got a sort of a primary timeline of motivations. And it took me the second watch to really get this. But correct me if I'm wrong, all right? So I've got four main points here. Gemma meets Mark. As a result of their relationship, she has a struggle with infertility. As a result of her infertility journey, as her paperwork said, she encounters the scientist on the floor below the floor at Severance. And as a result of her ongoing suffering, psychological trauma, she sort of embraces this new cult-like solution involving memory testing. And she winds up as sort of a rat in the maze down on the testing floor. Did I get any of that wrong?
Probably.
can, Can you prove it? Can you prove that?
I think that's probably right, except I don't think we're totally clear on the transition from Gemma at home to Gemma with Lumen. Like, I don't think we fully know her motivations there yet.
Well, we see Dr. Maurer just in passing in the fertility waiting room.
That is correct.
Mm-hmm. So, and I didn't catch that the first time around. And just a little glance, you know, the camera doesn't hang on him, but just a little glance, you see him check out Gemma.
Yep. So are you suggesting that then Gemma is working with him?
I think that she decides that she's going, you know, she gets on this mailing list where she gets the Chikai Bardo cards, right? She says, I think I got these on this mailing list because of the fertility treatment. I think that these Chikai Bardo cards are meant to kind of be a lure, like sometimes, you know, cultish groups will use sort of introductory reading material. And I think she gets on this, she thinks, so this is kind of interesting. It kind of gets my mind off my trauma. And then when she realizes, oh, actually they do testing where you can actually live other people's lives and not have to sort of suffer through your own, give me more of that. I think that's when they get their hooks in her and she ends up volunteering for long-term testing. That is my theory.
That's an interesting theory. I think it's wrong, but that's cool.
David, can you give us your hot takes?
Well, I'm still processing this episode. There's just no way that I could have ever predicted at the outset of this season that an episode like this could exist within the framework of the show.
Steve, do you think that David's feelings are right or wrong at this point?
They're right.
Okay. Continue, David.
You're more wrong the more he talks.
I need a woe meter. Should we hook me up to a woe meter?
Which opinion made your mouth hurt?
By the end of the episode, well, like somewhere in the middle of the episode, maybe after the montage, I was just so in love with both Mark and Gemma. They were just, they created such a depth of character with just these scenes and these, you know, sort of cut scenes out of their lives that it was just really palpable. And so when the heartbreak comes, it was just super impactful. The use of the visual storytelling to give us insights into the characters was just really incredible. Watching Mark destroy the baby carriage, the baby's crib, right? That indicates to me somebody who's bottled up his emotions and now it's all coming out destructively in this moment. So it tells me a lot about how Mark processes his feelings. Or Gemma is a very reserved person, but highly intelligent and her observation. The whole, at the end of the montage, there was the scene at lunch with Rickon and Devin and Gemma and Mark. And that, I have come to the belief that that whole scene, was designed for one frame. And that frame at the end of the scene, when Devin is looking back at Gemma when she realizes that Gemma's pregnant. That is 1,000 pages of exposition all boiled down into that one, whatever, you know, a minute, half a minute, you know, long scene. And that was just an incredible level of storytelling. And then it also tells me that Gemma has as much love for, Devin has as much love for Gemma as Mark does. And that's why she's been so invested in finding out this mystery.
I don't know, David, I'm going to disagree. I think that scene was more to lay a foundation of Rickon's outdoorsmanship. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I got more from that.
Okay. Fair enough. I'm really liking the use of color to denote the different spaces, you know, the different greens that we have on the testing floor, the whites, the Audi world is very dark right now, and they're using a lot of Rembrandt lighting. where inside the innies are well lit, unless they're running around the hallways at night. But, you know, there's this very innie outie lighting structure and color spaces as well. And along with the sound design to really cue emotional responses, there's a lot of heavy low tones in this, really good. And then just this episode, the grain, the soft focus, the 8mm, you know, the faux 8mm stuff, going from wide shots to medium shots to close-ups to extreme close-ups, like they were all over the place. And every shot told something of the story, using the circular camera to spin us around like a merry-go-round. The production design, the testing floor suites, Gemma's apartment, it gave me really space 1999 vibes, you know, like 70s future retro stuff. It was great. And then there's this whole question. I was just really intrigued by whose flashback was it? In whose dreams, whose journeys were we? Because sometimes we were with Gemma, yeah, and sometimes we were with Mark.
I have the same two, question.
Yeah, the two would flow together just beautifully. And I think my last wrap-up thought is Sandra Bernhardt, Steve, King of Comedy. Is that...
Yeah. Yeah, that always connect. That, I mean, she's got so much other work, and you know, as a stand-up and just various other performances. But King of Comedy always is the one that stands out to me.
Yeah, and that was her breakout, I think.
Mm. Yeah.
So, Steve, what's your hot take?
This is a very. I think I was a little apprehensive about this podcast just because I'm not really sure how to talk about this episode, to be perfectly honest. It's like, it's almost, like, I mean, because obviously now everything is cleared up, which is great. And so the rest of the show, I guess, is just a prologue or epilogue, but that's fine. I don't know. I'm not exactly sure where to go with it. I mean, it was so different, so jarring, unlike any other episode, not just in... structure, but just the look, the sound, which I think is really, really good. And I really think that we had in the last podcast kind of talked about how we're rooting for Mark and how we kind of tolerate Mark Scout, but root for Mark S. And this episode, I think, did a lot of work to sort of help us be mission focused, I think, right? First off, Hot Mark is a definite it's a refreshing thing to have. You know, Adam Scott, little bit of a snack in this episode, which I like. Hair goes a long way, but
it does.
But so it's just fascinating to see this play out, and where Anthony has his theory about Gemma maybe getting lured by this cult, which is an interesting take that I hadn't really thought of. I guess I saw this more as, I mean, maybe alluring, but maybe all the way to, it doesn't seem to me, again, we don't get a lot of the story, you know, we get sort of a broad stroke, but with the choices they made, I saw a growing separateness between them, but not one that would indicate to me that she's just be like, all right, well, I'll just fake my death now and join this cult.
I don't know if she faked her death.
That her death was faked. You're aware that's right.
It was faked. Does she know that Mark thinks that she's dead?
Well,
that's a good question.
She knows that she's gone.
Let me suggest
that she can't see Mark.
Since you're having trouble with this, let me help you out here. So, it could be that she says, yes, I would like to undergo long-term trials. She checks in. And then Lumen, to make it look like she's dead, she doesn't really know what's going on in the outside world. They fake her death without her knowledge.
Yeah, I don't think that lines up, though, with the dialogue later in the episode, because when she says, I want to see Mark, they say, well, Mark moved on. He's remarried. Right. He has a daughter now. And that, to me, says he thinks she's dead. And she knows that.
I think Dr. Maurer is actually in love with her, and he's now wanting to keep her for himself.
Mr. Drummond basically told us,
but the idea that if she's thinks she's just doing long-term testing, and then and Mark's just like waiting for her, you know? I mean, like she wants to see Mark again. She says that. She went, now can I go see Mark? That doesn't suggest to me that she seems like she's a prisoner, but she's being told that she can leave under, you know, after she has some sort of, she serves her purpose is what I'm gathering. I mean, I just don't see what they chose to show us. Like I said, they definitely showed that there was a rift and a fracture between their relationship, you know, causing, you know, because of the infertility issues and how they're dealing with it and how they went from this like kind of, you know, idyllic existence to where they are now. That's a pretty big leap to be like, well, I'm going to now just do long-term testing without telling my husband.
It just seems
like
that. Does she think that she's checking in for a week? Does she think that she's checking in for 2 years? And does she have a sense of that time once she's there?
Well, what do you think she's checking in for?
I think she finds some kind of solace in this group she's going to.
What's wrong with the group that has charades?
Yeah, the group that has charades, right? she finds something to take her mind off her grief, and maybe there's a little bit of relief in sort of playing with reframing memories. She finds that attractive. She thinks, I'll just go to this thing, and then she's gone. She's just gone. And we don't really know what transpires after that. But I think that she gets involved with Lumen as a result of her grief, like so many of these other characters do.
I think that's definitely right. I think I'm just questioning whether she knows that.
I think she's a prisoner.
Yeah, yeah.
She becomes a prisoner for sure. Does she enter Lumen voluntarily, or do they abduct her?
I mean, I'm not willing to give Lumen a lot of benefit of the doubt for doing things a good way, just based on what I've seen this episode particularly. I mean,
but you know that they have ironclad contracts in place.
Yeah,
you know, so, like she signed her life away that day.
Right. So, I mean, it could be one of those things where she didn't realize that she was what she had signed up for, and then now she signed up for it, right? I mean, she's going through an awful lot of, you know, physical, psychological testing, and all these different things are going on. That does not suggest to me that Lumen cares a whole lot about how they do the things.
No, but they will deceive. You know, they'll send Milchick to your house and he's going to smile a lot and, you know, try to smooth things over. Lumen has a forward-facing voice to the sort of the community. It's very different than the sort of the stern authoritarian face that they show that the innies. So I could see this kind of, I could see a card like the Bardo, what do they call it? The Chikai Bardo cards designed to put hooks into people who are going through grief. Like if you destroy your own ego, then really what you're doing is you're destroying your own suffering, and we can help you do that.
I wonder if
Steve, can I interrupt you briefly?
It's your thing apparently.
Point of order that those Chikai Bardo cards, right? They freaked out when Dylan that got a hold of one of them?
Yeah.
And they moved. They spent a significant amount of energy tracking that thing back down.
Uh-huh.
But then we find that there's a lot of them, and so I don't wonder that through these fertility clinics and other things. So this goes back into the cloning theory, and to me, I think what maybe is a trigger to all of this is they found in Gemma the right combination of genetics or what have you, and whether by hook or by crook, they got a hold of her, that they had found her genetic material or whatever, and then and have her in for that purpose. But if they're sending those cards out to a lot of people, right, why do you have so many cards? Because they're blanketing all these fertility clinics. Anybody who signs up and gets on the mailing list gets these cards.
I mean, missionaries Steve. Keep the printing business in play. You know, there's no there's no printing business without the Jehovah's Witnesses and the Mormon Church.
Steve, please.
So yeah, so I mean, it is an interesting way that they could be luring her in. The question is did she volunteer for maybe severance? Because she was having some issues, or they, because there's something like, I mean, because they go through the severance procedure in a cultish fashion. Does it seem incongruous with where they were going, or you know, because Mark and all, from what we gather, the other folks being severed, there's a reason, there's a method. What would she be severing from, right? And so she. We know she's severed. We now know that you can have multiple innies when you're severed. The getting there part, I think, is pretty crucial to this, is to, you know, to find out, is Lumen able to convince her versus she was abducted, or, I mean, this, it's a pretty big thing. And it goes back to like what you're saying, Dave, with them. You know, they found something in her. I mean, blood is a theme very heavily in this episode. Mm-hmm. We start with them donating blood. The next shot is her blood being extracted. They go out of their way to show the
Lumen
blood
logo
in the finger, the miscarriage. We even mentioned his nosebleed. And so I wonder if it's not her, but it is Mark. And she's sort of still a way to get to Mark, but at the same time, they're just going to continue to use her, because like what she's doing down there right now really just feels like she's the guinea pig to test a more commercial use of severance, like not just for work, but you can use it for any aspect of your life that you don't want to deal with. You know, if you're afraid of flying, here, get severed. If you don't like going to the dentist, get severed.
Yeah.
If you don't want to have to write like hella thank you notes, get severed. you know, but so it's like so that part of it is like, like I understand, all right, I'm gathering that kind of thing, but I'm not understanding why her, because it's, as far as we can tell, there's not a lot of people going to these different rooms. Like, what is it about Gemma and or Mark that makes this experiment so specific and so unique to them?
It's the face card. It's the face card. Now, that's what the kids are always saying, is that Miss Casey's performance is always 90% face card. But she finally got to act this episode, and I appreciate that. And it was really a pleasure to watch. David, you always have the actors' names up. What's this actor's name?
Oh my God, are you calling me out on this right now?
You're always the guy. You're the production guy. I got my lighting. I got my zollies. I got my actors.
I was looking up podcast ratings.
Okay. Well, anyway.
I got it here. It's coming. Give me half a second. Mark's family.
Dyken Lechman. I cannot pronounce this. Anyway, she's doing a great job. Lachman. That's all I want to say. I don't want to give too many more hot takes because we're already over 20 minutes just doing hot takes. And I think we're already covering a lot of the materials we're going to cover during the theory crafting and all that. So why don't we take that quick break? When we get back, we will get deeper into the theories.
Hey, Mark, I was listening to Paramore the other day, and it really made me think about the amygdala and the limbic system.
You just made those words up, didn't you?
What, Paramore?
We're the Nevermind the Music podcast, where one musician
and one psychologist
talk songwriting and the mind, one song at a time.
We'll hear everything from Green Day and Outkast
to Stevie Wonder and Dua Lipa.
And we mostly try to stay on topic.
Except for when we don't want to.
Nevermind the Music, wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're back. So let's get into the different plot lines. It's really, I have these here for organization, but, and David suggested the topics to me, because when I first looked at this episode, I was like, how the fuck do I outline this? It's just, it's like 80% theory crafting and theory answering. So let's just talk about the different aspects here. So Mark and Gemma in real world, Mark and Gemma. After a meet cute at a Lumen blood drive, Mark and Gemma fall in love. We also get a lovely brunch with Rickon. They eventually begin to try to conceive, and after a miscarriage, they go to a fertility clinic. Things get tense in their house as Mark disassembles their crib, and Gemma heads out to a party with charades.
Yeah, you know, Manny, Mark, do you know how many marriages IKEA has ruined?
That's a whole plot line in 30 Rock. Have you seen that episode?
No.
They say the IKEA workers following Tina Fey's character and her partner around going, and every time they start fighting, he goes, yes, yes, more.
Right. That's a Star Trek Dave. That's Day of the Dove with the evil entity absorbing the negative emotions.
It's like, I live for this. Anyway, so the police come at the end and Mark doesn't open the door. And I think that that's important. That's what I'll start with, is I think it's important that we didn't get a definitive answer of how she got there. I think they are withholding that deliberately. And all we can do at this point is speculate.
I want to just touch on that montage again. And that's one of our needle drops, which is a Belgian singer, the La Valais à Mille Temps. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly in French. I apologize. The Waltz with a Thousand Beats is the English translation of it. And I just loved how they told the story of their relationship and the depth of feelings that they had for each other and their lives together in this really just visually and auditorily just very moving way. And the song, the refrain of the song goes, it's very long. It goes on and on, but I'll just read the first few stanzas. A waltz in three beats that still takes the time, that still takes the time to take detours, draw towards love, how charming life. A waltz in four beats is much less danceable, but just as charming. A waltz in 20 beats is much more troubling. And it just goes on and on like that. And so they really chose a song that, echoes the trajectory of the characters as they're struggling, you know, as they're just going through their daily life, but then end up into this really unfortunate situation of the question of fertility.
Yeah, I pulled up all right, so here are the lyrics that I pulled up. Mm-hmm. And I'm my French is really rusty, but mine says shock the monkey. Ooh, monkey. Monkey. So I don't know where you got these lyrics, David.
I think David just wrote a poem and wanted to share it with us.
I asked my AI companion to write a poem for me.
It might have been questionable translation, but it was a lot about carousels and very, very repetitive about carousels and
this is fantastic podcasting.
Yeah. So well, there's a ton of stuff to talk about in this part. That is not the lyrics of the song that we can't agree on.
Are you sure we should move on, John?
I think we should take several more minutes to dissect this. but if not, dear listener, I want to talk about the fertility clinic.
Okay, good.
The fertility clinic, first of all, we have Dr. Maurer. I'm sorry. So sorry. He worked hard for that fake degree. And The line that really got me is when Mark goes over to Gemma and he says, hey, it's the next step for a lot of people. I love you. What he should have said was, it's the next step for a lot of people. It doesn't have to be our next step. That, and I think he almost said it. But it was so clear that like Mark is really attached to this idea of having a kid. And he can't even bring himself to comfort Gemma all the way because this is his like dream in life is to go have a kid. And I feel like they do a really good job in this writing. It's very subtle to basically say like Mark slowly becomes less of the person that Gemma can rely on. And that's why she's getting pushed towards these more extreme. Yeah,
she says, I'm sorry. And of course he like shakes his head like you shouldn't have to be sorry, but he doesn't say it.
Right.
So there's a sense in which she's almost more sorry for him. But, you know, I think it's to go from the meet cute to the suffering that infertility brings in a space of 20 minutes is really something. It's just, you really needed this episode. And this is what Sarah was saying to me earlier. She said, you really needed to find out why Mark is in love with Gemma. Because really all of it is sort of obscured by the way that they've been telling the story. But we never got to really invest in that relationship. And because of that, maybe we care less about Gemma than we do about baby goats. And so this episode was really important to have us invest in that relationship so that something's at stake. There's a reason why we should care that maybe any Mark doesn't care about finding her anymore. And that's a problem. So anyway, excellent storytelling in terms of getting us to invest in those two.
Yeah. And, you know, something that my wife sent me, she sent me a screenshot, I think, of a TikTok comment from Spicy Garbage. That's who wrote this. But it's a great take. Mark Scout, Audi Mark, is Orpheus trying to save Eurydice. Mark S. is Odysseus going to war for Helen of Troy. And so, you know, Mark Scout wants to go into Hades and rescue his wife. That's Orpheus and Eurydice. Mm-hmm. And then Mark S. is, I think it's more of just the Helena thing, you know, the Helena heli of it, but going to war for Helen of Troy. I think that's a really interesting, like, are these two going to clash internally now that he's reintegrating?
I think that's an interesting question, is what is reintegration going to do, especially that given that any Mark S. has been developing feelings for Heli, and how is that going to complicate his motivations? Because we're clearly left at the end of the episode with the depth of his feeling when Devin asks him, you know, like, hey, you know, how are you doing, as he's coming up and out, and he has that moment, and then we get that dissolve to Gemma's eyes and the sadness on his face.
What Mark came up or came to, you think?
Oh, that's a good question.
Oh, maybe integrated Mark. Maybe it's both and.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I think this is fully reintegrated. If you want to bring in the wake up stuff, I think we can just say Rigabi tests Mark's responsiveness and tells Devin he'll be fine, but needs time to wake up. When Devin panics and tries to call Miss Cobell to get to Demona birthing retreat, Rigabi leaves to protect herself. Then Mark wakes up remembering Gemma. So we got the birthing retreat back.
Mm-hmm.
So back to what David, you were asking before, like how much of this is Gemma's perspective versus how much of this is Mark's perspective?
And it's beautiful. I think it beautifully seesaws us through both.
It does. However, I wonder, okay, let me ask this. Was there ever a scene that would give us just Mark without Gemma and something that Gemma would have no view to? Because I think a case could be made that this entire episode is her processing.
What about because the police, the police coming at the end. She wasn't there for that.
Okay, that's right. That's right.
Yeah.
I think I thought the answer was both. I thought the reason why we could get both perspectives is because both perspectives were sort of happening. I got the sense that maybe it mattered less. I mean, the question is are these, how much of these are flashbacks versus how much of this is a story being told for us?
Both and.
Yeah. And so I don't know. I mean, I think there was a point made that was important for all of us to understand that Gemma exists as Gemma on the testing floor. And
correct.
And we got a sense of what that means and what, you know, Gemma wants. Like, if she left Mark, she wants him back. If she was abducted by Mark, she wants to be free. Like, whatever. We don't know those details yet. Also, I'm sure we all know this, and I'm just being dumb. How much time are we talking about between her death and now?
About two years.
Okay. She's had to go back to the testing floor, right? So, I mean, is this just something that, is this her everyday life? Is, uh, she's sometimes Miss Casey, sometimes, you know, getting her teeth. I know, like it's been 6 weeks since she had her mm-hmm. teeth last worked on, but I mean that, like that, there's a lot of different questions that come up, and then obviously these other rooms, and now we get a sense of what the testing is to some degree. Like, I mean, we assume the testing, like if, before we assumed that testing was being done on her, and I think it still is, but she's also being a test subject as well, like for Severance, it feels. And I think it's interesting that we brought back the birth retreat, because this is, to our knowledge, the only other place, I think, where you can just take a mini sever. Or a very yeah. specific sever.
And we know the legislators are trying to get it more widely spread.
Right, right.
Yeah, in addition to that, we've confirmed you can be severed in multiple areas of your mind, right?
Right. So you could get this chip, and now you could be like, hey, you know what I don't like doing? I don't like going to the dentist. I also don't like taking flights. So I can do all these different things as long as there is a severed elevator or some sort of a portal or whatever that would activate it,
mm-hmm.
you could do. And that's so that gives you a bigger, it's an interesting new dilemma, because I did walk away from this, and I'm curious what you guys think. Like, well, what if this is it? What if all this Lumen mm-hmm. stuff is really just trying to push this technology throughout the world? And if that's it, are you bummed? Because it's not clones, or because it's not that, or is that enough? It's... You know, like if it's, you know, I mean, I still think there's a lot more. I mean, I think Lumen is too big, but I'm just, but this is a big episode where at least this would intersect with the political narrative that was brought up with the senator and this idea of commercialization. And also, I mean, it's a pretty big deal if you could get a bunch of people to have your chips in their brains.
I don't put it past Lumen to be able to try to figure out the marketing angle of it. I still think that there is some sort of fertility angle on this, you know, for Keir and all that. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to pick up a thought that you were putting down there, Steve, which is having these severed spaces, be it a doctor's, you know, office or a living room, as a prison, what an insidious failsafe that if you escape the bounds of the prison, you cross back over into some sort of compliant version of yourself.
Mm-hmm.
That was the failsafe when she went up the elevator. Yeah. They were like, oh, it was still kind of a panic moment, but right. It wasn't a complete freak out, because they knew that the moment she gets up into the elevator, she's going to be Miss Casey. And how insidious is that as a technology?
Right.
Interesting too. Milchek rocking the jacket and out of breath, which suggests he had probably like left for the day and uh-huh. he had a quick hop on the bike and get back.
Absolutely.
Yeah. There's also this line that Maurer says to Gemma that says, after you go into Cold Harbor, you will see the world again and the world will mm-hmm. see you. And so that's what makes me think, no, this cannot be the end game, is just severance. Right. There has to be something more that's going to happen to Gemma.
Well, and I don't know if I felt more or less. I last time I said I felt this, that Mark's a bit on a suicide mission. It kind of implied that, perhaps, like even beyond the reintegration part, but like his pain would be go away. You know, it seemed as though, like, obviously that they would not necessarily be reunited, but it was all very, you know, like the, like you said before, you know, like speak no, you know, no lies. I mean, it's like Keir will erase your pain. And what does that mean? That could mean anything. I mean, that could mean you don't have any pain because you're dead.
I think they will be more than ready to dispose of Mark once Cold Harbor is done.
Right.
Absolutely. Yeah. He is definitely a tool and nothing more.
Mm-hmm.
There's also, you know, there's this title of the episode, Chakai Bardo. And we had somebody on the Discord explaining that to us. Chumbaruni comes in with his wisdom and says the title of the episode refers to the Buddhist bardo, which is the state one enters immediately at death until the moment of rebirth. End quotes. The fourth bardo begins when the dying process begins, specifically when the outer and inner signs presage, that the onset of death is nigh. The bardo continues through the dissolution or transmutation of the elements until the external and internal breath has completed. This element dissolution leads to the state of consciousness known as the clear light of death. Those who were experienced at voluntarily sustaining the clear light consciousness during life are capable of retaining lucid awareness throughout the clear light, while others lose lucid awareness, blacking out. Meditation practitioners train to retain lucidity during the clear light of death by practicing sustaining lucidity during the clear light of sleep state. Accessed via lucid deep sleep, the recognition of the clear light of death leads to the state of tukdam. So a lot there.
Okay, let me just point out real quick.
Yeah.
There's a lot of those themes that fit very well within the Tolstoy short story, The Death of Ivan Ilyich.
Mm-hmm.
And
in Tolstoy?
I've never read a story before, okay, but I read it this morning.
Nice. <Yeah. laughs>
And well done. Because it's name checked twice in this episode.
As is another story.
Okay. So I read it and it fits perfectly, a very Western perspective, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But it fits perfectly with a lot of the themes that you were just recounting there, John.
And then there's the other book, which gets Tolstoy book, which gets name checked, which is Haj Murat. She says she has a lecture on him in 30 minutes. And that was about a rebel commander in Dagestan and about struggle and remaining faithful. I read the Wikipedia article. I didn't read the Wikipedia article on Ivan Ilyich.
That short story by Tolstoy, it doesn't necessarily help. It didn't really help me theory craft, but it really does help me understand the tone of this episode.
Hmm.
The tone moving from sort of a carefree life to a life of like preoccupation with your own pain and ultimately moving to a realization that you could have lived life differently. And then this kind of religious experience of death. So it was a great read. It only took me a couple hours. But worth it if you're interested in kind of understanding sort of, I guess, Mark's psychological development.
Well, can we also apply that to the reintegration and how he's basically two versions of himself have to die in order for the reintegration to work. And it has to be kind of become something new, right?
Huh. I mean,
it's kind of a combination of these two, but it's now a matter of reconciling, these two, there's two egos, right? I mean, he's two different motivations, two different, perspectives on world, two different sets of memories now coming together. And so it's neither any Mark nor Audi Mark can exist in the same way that they've ever existed before.
Right. And so he has to suffer an ego death, which she talks about with the cards, right?
Right.
And so if Mark is going to reintegrate, he can't have two egos. He's got to have one ego.
Or no ego.
Right. And then reading, when I watched him wake up, and it's like, clearly you have this episode where, you know, dealing with memories and this relationship. And so we assume because of the way that the story is told that, like, he's remembering her and that's why he's sad. I'm not sure that that's the only reason why he's sad. I think he's different. I think he woke up pretty different. And
Rugabi says he's journeying.
Right.
Yeah.
And so I think he's, you know, I mean, he may be mourning, he may be sad at this memory of Gemma, but he may be also mourning you can't go back to these. These memories are really just that, and they're very fleeting at this point. And so, like, his life is forever different, and he has to now reconcile that.
Yeah.
That's probably true. I do think that we get a sense that he's probably blames himself for her death. You know, mm-hmm. We didn't know before that she offered to stay.
Yeah.
Like, do you want to come? No, maybe I should stay. No, you should go. I've got to work on this writing project. And she goes, and now not only is she dead because of it, according from Mark's perspective, he told her to go, and mm-hmm. He chose himself not to go. So to me, that tells me a little bit more about why he's grieving her. He's not just grieving the death of his beloved. He also feels guilt. He's processing his own guilt at, pushing her away and then, like, literally sending her out on the journey that leads to her death.
With a cherry on top of the fact that she had to remind him to say, I love you back.
That's right. That's right.
It's a great point that it's mirroring, right? And I think somebody pointed out there was, like, a similar tree, too, in the Christmas house. There's some weird mirroring happening. And then you just get back to, like, how long were they watching Gemma and Mark? Adam J. wrote in with an email saying, Lumen Industries manufactures a range of life science products and personalized medical services, including pharmaceuticals, medical equipment, cosmetics, and personal care items. It is reasonable to assume that this encompasses IVF and human reproduction. Mark and Gemma's supposedly unsuccessful attempts would likely have occurred in QRPE under the supervision of Lumen doctors. This medical access would provide Lumen with almost limitless human embryos.
Oh, testing, no.
Including those of the scouts.
Yeah.
Maybe yep. Miss Casey/Gemma's cryptically shortened message to Mark, your Audi is going to ... will be finished, is finished with be a father. As someone who had anguish through 6 years of IVF struggles, which finally resulted in a daughter, I'm acutely aware of the number of embryos harvested, frozen, and lost in the real world. It would be simple for Lumen to mislead couples like the scouts.
Is it? I mean, don't put anything past Lumen, but are we to sort of read this to mean that Lumen is responsible for the miscarriage?
Could be.
That was one of my earlier thoughts when I watched it the first time. It was like, just the amount of, you know, who knows what. Because, like, we already heard, Helena say that, you know, she took a non-Lumen, was it painkiller it was for the rash or whatever. So the idea being that, like, they have control over all of this, right? I mean, so if they're taking any type of, you know, hormone increaser or any type of even just a vitamin supplement, I mean, chances are it's from Lumen, so there's all kinds of different things they could do. I mean, I think it is important too, that since, you know, you brought up the how many embryos and, you know, we're not ready to give up on maybe a cloning or whatever. I mean, why is there a mirrored macro data refining group, right?
That was my biggest question.
Why are they,
looked like the fake Dylan from the Orpo, yeah. Right? Was in there.
And they're sitting facing out as opposed to facing in.
So if they're not the same ones that were at the Ortbo, that would suggest that there's other ones like this. And it's like, mm-hmm. So there's, again, it's, and we already, and you have to look at the door, the boss at the door factory. It's like, there just seems to be a lot of similar people, right? I mean, just kind of floating around.
Yeah. Not only do they have to be observed, we have to dress you like the person you're observing.
Right. Yeah.
Right down to facial hair. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. So that adds a layer of, you know, but you've got Dr. Maurer playing every character.
Yes. And he has an excellent choice in sweaters.
Can I just say
he's a coach at one point, right? He's got like a whistle around his neck.
And he's the airline steward.
Steward scene was amazing.
What was that?
They've got like a full on like simulator down there.
I guess so.
A gimbal.
Yeah. Just one more thought on the babies of it all. Film Burning wrote in and said, just a thought, why has no one made the connection between the intercourse in episode 4 and the baby Kier in the opening sequence. Maybe it's a sign of our times that intercourse and babies are not an obvious connection, but that was the first thing I saw when watching the episode. Please keep up the great work. So that has me thinking, like, are they trying to like make a baby where they can implant Kier or Egan consciousnesses?
Yeah, I think that's a legit possibility.
Yeah, for Kier. Right, that there's some sort of lineage, a question of lineages of Kier that they're doing, and be it clones, be as you know, was Gemma? Is this a revenant of Gemma, or is this a cloned Gemma that's been regrown? Or and she's going through her behavioral training, sort of a la Westworld, you know, going through all of these cycles of testing phases so that they can get the variances down to almost zero before she can be released into the world. And then that's a prototype for a Kier, you know, ultimately coming back.
Maybe the mark she remembers is not the mark that we think she remembers.
Let me just throw out a little theory here. I think that it's I don't know if I think this, but let me throw this against the wall. Kier has identified Mark as someone with the right makeup.
Correct.
To like bring about the second coming of Kier. Like he's got the right set of tempers, or he's got the right DNA to do it. Maybe he's a descendant of Kier. I don't know. But they've identified this guy. This guy is going to continue the lineage, and we're going to bring Kier back into the world, and then insert Kier mine into baby or something like that. But that's why they need both Gemma and Mark, both husband and wife. Of course, if they're not going to be able to get Gemma prepared, I guess, for this, if it's not going to work, Helena takes it upon herself, like, okay, if we can't get him to impregnate her, I'm going to do it. It's going to be me. I'm going to go sleep with the guy. I'm going to make sure that we bring about his descendant through me or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Does that work for you?
I think so. And perhaps even they would prefer it to be through Heli so that it's the same like bloodline with Kier.
Well, but she, yeah, I guess that makes sense. Yeah, because it was Heli R that they had the experience, but also they had Helena went for it on her own.
Yeah.
I don't know how, because I guess I'm a little unclear as to how excited everybody was about Helena going in there and doing that, doing any of it, right?
Because I think she took it upon herself. Like, I'm gonna call an audible here. I'm gonna go for Plan B.
Well, she's not gonna go for Plan B. That's the point.
Unless it's Lumen sanctioned.
Ba-dum-tsh.
Well, so okay, so was that? I guess from a timeline perspective, that all happened because of the overtime contingency happening. What was anything leading to that prior? I mean, you know what I mean? It's like, this is all sort of a result of, you know, of that incident. I mean, before it just looked like it was just people doing macro data refinement.
Well, I think that gets into the question of the correlation of the file names to the rooms.
Mm-hmm. Because Cold Harbor still clearly matters. I mean, it clearly matters, and we're seeing that it didn't even have its name on the door until previously. Right. So I don't know. You know,
it's the final room.
Yeah, we're not exactly sure what the timeline too of what we saw with Gemma downstairs matches up with everything else, right? I mean,
can I ask you guys a question? I forget why Cobell had Gemma sent back to the testing floor. There was some causal moment where they're like, because Cobell was watching during season one. She was watching the interactions with Gemma and then with Gemma and Mark very carefully. And she was like, and I remember there was a line where maybe it was Milchek said to her or somebody said something about, it doesn't like they seem like they remember each other, and that's a good thing.
So, yeah, Milchek says, you know, it's a good thing that they don't remember each other. It means that the chips are working. They send Gemma in to do a wellness session with Mark, and he sculpts a tree. Now, the tree... Right,
which we see flashbacks of in this episode.
That's right. So the tree that he sculpts with clay shows that he remembers his grief from the outie world.
Mm.
Because that is the site of Gemma's death.
Mm-hmm.
As a result of that, Miss Cobell says, send her back to the testing floor, meaning that we don't have this perfected. Because clearly, he's got some kind of psychological connection to a tree, which he should not have.
So they sent her back to the testing floor, not as a defect of Miss Casey, but because Mark's emotional resonance was bleeding through.
That's the tricky part. And it's interesting to me that on the testing floor, that group of sort of mirror refiners, they're not just watching which numbers that are being chosen. They're watching the facial cues of the refiners themselves, almost as if they're mapping something about the refiners. Like I think we know for certain now that, you know, Dylan and Irv and Mark and Heliar, they are being set up on a floor to be observed. They're not just being observed by Cobell or Milchick or whoever.
And even by the obvious cameras. There are cameras, and they showed us the spiral of all the fiber optics running down, and they were a lot.
The computers that they're using are also registering their facial cues and whatnot.
And they're watching everything, which makes the comment that Mark says to Heli, well, when Helena was down here, you know, she was spying on us, so they know everything. It's like, bro, they've known everything the entire time.
Right,
It's like people that say, like, oh, I don't want to have...
hey, guys.
they don't want to have an Amazon Echo in the house because it's listening, but they'll have their phone with them everywhere they go.
Right, exactly. All right, let's take a quick break. When we get back, we'll go down to the testing floor.
Hey everyone, David here. And like a certain author once wrote, your so-called boss may own the clock that taunts you from the wall, but the hour is yours. And we're using our hours to bring you comprehensive coverage of Severance Season 2. Here's something really simple we're doing. A season pass for just $5. That's it, one payment, no subscription, no complexity. So what exactly is a season pass? It's a dedicated ad-free feed that gives you permanent access to all of our weekly episodes for season 2, our exclusive Supply Closet bonus series, and Steve and Anthony's complete season 1 rewatch. In our Supply Closet episodes so far, we've had fascinating conversations with the team from Nevermind the Music. Mark broke down the 4 signature chords of the main musical theme and how they connect to the show's themes, while Nicole has explored the neuroscience behind different types of memory, where personality lives in the brain, as well as brainwave oscillations and reintegration. We've got more exciting conversations planned. We'll be announcing those soon. Look, we know everyone's dealing with subscription fatigue these days. That's why we made this super straightforward. $5, one time, everything's included. 2 clicks, and you're done. And while we can't promise you any goats, we can promise all of our episodes will leave you feeling just as refreshed as any wellness session. Head over to lorehoundsnetwork.supercast.com to get your season pass. You can also find the link in our show notes below. Need help? Visit us at lorehounds.com and use our contact page.
And remember, should you find yourself questioning which version of you is listening to this podcast, that is the version that needs to listen most.
All right, and we're back. Let's go to the testing floor where Gemma goes through testing by an unnamed woman on the testing floor before being walked through the halls to 6 rooms where a severed personality takes over. In the Wellington room, Dr. Maurer performs a dental procedure on her. Gemma also goes to a Christmas-themed room where she's forced to write thank you cards for her pretend husband, Dr. Maurer, and she has to go on a simulated plane crash. When she asks to see Mark, Dr. Maurer says Mark has remarried and has a daughter. She doesn't believe him, hits him over the head with a chair, and tries to escape. The elevator takes her to the severed floor where she becomes Miss Casey and is sent back down to the testing floor.
Yeah.
There on the thank you card things, there was somebody dropped a line earlier in this same episode. Was it Mark who said, I don't like writing thank you cards or something like that? Like when he brought the ant farm to her?
I think she says, or this is when they did a different scene. She's saying like, oh, I should write a thank you to like the, I don't know if it was the clinic or something. She's like, but you hate writing.
Okay.
So there's all these room names, and I could list them, but I think everyone can use their eyes and ears. But the Cold Harbor, obviously the most significant one. And we had a piece of feedback that I thought was really interesting. This has probably already been mentioned, but I'm reading The Power Broker, which tells the story of how Robert Moses put a roadway right through the center of a farm in Cold Spring Harbor, splitting the farm in two. One side was apparently fertile, the other not so.
Hmm.
As soon as I saw the location, I had this series in mind. So I thought the splitting was especially interesting if it hadn't been mentioned. So thanks for WD-40 for writing in with that. I mean, the fertility on one side, that's even with this episode. I mean, come on.
And it would be, it would fit with the theme of sort of a corporate structure imposing its will on, you know, I guess upper class, lower class divide, and the consequences that someone high up in the government can have on someone who's more of a blue collar person. And it kind of fits with some of the other themes that we've been looking at. Yeah, I like that. I don't know what to do with that information beyond that. I think it, for me, the title of that room just confirmed that whatever Cold Harbor is, it's a room specifically designed to enact some kind of unpleasant situation. Like all of these rooms are simulations of something that you might want to avoid.
Yeah.
And
you've got fear in a couple of them. Yeah. You've got pain.
Yeah. Different kinds of torture, kind of.
And what did he say to her though? When she says, when you go through that door,
the world will see you and you will see the world.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And also that Mark, when she says, well, will I see Mark then? He's like, Mark will benefit from the world that you create. Right. So, right. So not promising anything.
the term siring is an interesting.
Right. Yeah.
Joan, you've gotten what, 5 books into 6 of Dune? And I don't want to segue too far off, but this reminds me of a little bit of how they wake up Agola.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's book 2. I think you can get into that a little bit. Are there any other Dune heads here?
No, I think it's just you and I. But anyway, it just makes me think of, you know, using emotion to reactivate or activate something in the psychology.
Yeah, so. This biological memory.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because they're putting her through a lot of psychological stresses, right? I mean, maybe they're doing some physiological exams with the dental work every 6 weeks, but they're putting her through some, and then they're giving her the woe meter,
mm-hmm.
right? Nurse Bernhardt gives her those 2 things, and if you look, I screenshotted this. It says woe meter on the center of that little console. So there's some sort of bioelectrical feedback that they're measuring with that. And so she asks her a question of what is it? A mudslide, right? Would you rather drown or suffocate?
Yeah.
Does this bring back or bring you into like the e-meters that you would see in Scientology?
Oh, I don't know about this.
Yeah. When I did my little tour of the Celebrity Center, in Hollywood, One of the things they do is they hook you up to an e-meter where you hold it. You hold these two like metal rods that are connected, and then you're supposed to think of an event that happened, you know, that maybe caused you some distress. Oh. And it'll create, once you do that, then the meter will jump up and they can read, and it gives them a sense of, I think, like, to the severity of what this memory is doing to you and how it's shaped who you are. And that's part of, I think, the audit process too, is from that.
Doesn't he ask her too about her experiences? What is it she says? I think I have it somewhere in my notes, and they're not the normal, woe frolic, things, but it's like gaiety. Where is it? Oh, despair, fervor, and gaiety. Did you experience despair, fervor, or gaiety?
Yeah, these are just examples that Dr. Maurer, I think, is using for her. She can't remember anything. She has the sensation of pain, like her hand hurts, her jaw hurts. She cannot remember anything at all, which suggests, and I think that Drummond actually says it, he's like, you know, the walls are holding.
Yeah.
So you've got that element. You've also got a little bit of a suggestion that, well, all right. So I don't really know Dr. Maurer's whole deal, but he suggests that she's easy to like, and that she likes me too, or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then Drummond says, "Didn't she try to break your fingers?" Right. So we get the sense that maybe this isn't the first time she's tried to escape.
It's a good question.
That's a good point. That's a really good point.
And maybe she just didn't before. Maybe she didn't make it as far as the elevator. I don't know what the heck. Mm-hmm. But I was early on, I was thinking, why does she continue to put herself through this? She has memories of Mark. She's not fully severed down there. She knows who Mark is. So why are you continuing to allow this to go on for so long? And then when Drummond says, did she try to break your fingers? I thought, oh no, this is not her first time that she tried to escape.
Yeah, she just can't. There's no exit.
Yeah.
All exits are severed, right? I mean, that's the thing, is they can just redirect. It's like, well, you can choose to, you can leave and then be on a plane that's perpetually crashing if you want.
Hotel California ain't got nothing on the seventh floor. Right.
They just need Rugabe to get down there and punch a hole in her head, and she'll be fine.
Can I just? I'm so frustrated with Rugabe. I'm so frustrated. Or just the people around her. I want someone to just sit down, Rugabe. Let's take 5 minutes. Please explain to me what's going on with Lumen.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right.
I mean, I guess maybe that would ruin the storytelling. But every single time I think, gosh, this woman knows so much and she's telling us so little.
It is the one thing that bugs me the most about a lot of mid-tier television shows is, I'm too busy to explain what's happening, so I'm going to explain that I can't explain. Oh my God, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she just, I love that Devin says, will you just please answer one of my questions?
Yeah. Yeah.
She's so frustrated.
Also, I have custody of his brain now. You don't.
Yeah. Beautiful line.
Okay.
But I think it does a good thing to say that, well, so it creates doubt in Rugabe's intentions to some degree, right?
It does.
I mean, if she knows, she sort of has to reveal that Gemma's alive because she can't quite get Mark to do what she needs until she reveals that. So it's like, there's a lot of information she sits on that she reveals when it serves her purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the same way that Lumen appears to have chosen Mark, it feels like Rugabe's also just going to be, you know, using, like, he's kind of collateral damage. Like, maybe she doesn't see him as important or doesn't care. She's got another mission involved. So I think so that's what I think it ends up doing, right? Whether or not that's true or not, it just sows more seeds of doubt for Rugabe's intentions, but the fact that she's not revealing anything more than she feels comfortable with. And then now she's just going to bounce?
I mean, that's pretty, it's pretty dramatic. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. you have what could be your first supposed, like, actually working reintegration subject. Mm-hmm. And because Devin's like, well, I'm going to make a phone call. She's like, well, then I'm just going to leave. You made this choice. I mean, it's a very, like, kind of leave in a huff kind of a thing that really doesn't, yep. does it, like, there's no, let me explain to you what the stakes are. This is why you can't involve Cobell. Just take a moment. This is a bigger deal than what you're going. I also care about your brother's well-being. Like, there's none of that. It's just, okay, fine. If you're going to be that way, then I'm out. Nuh-uh. Sorry. Have a nice life. You know, it's a really, it was a very odd and abrupt way to end that actually, to me, seemed kind of in line with the out world that I'm more used to. I'm used to the Rebecca's of the world. I'm used to Rickon parties. So it's like, yeah, I need people to be a little weirder, because I also want to know, how come Rickon went from being kind of chill and interesting to this guy? Like, what happened?
So, yeah, that can maybe be explained through Ragabi's sort of personality deficiencies. But then Devin does this thing where she's like, I don't understand any of this. Let me just call Cobell. At what point is this a good idea? She's going to call Cobell? Like, I don't understand Devin's motivation. This is the woman who pretended to be your lactation consultant. And then,
like, kind of stole your baby. Yeah.
Yes. And then left town and pretended to be, you know, Mark's next door neighbor. Why do you think that you can trust your brother's brain with this woman? And so when Ragabi, like, freaks out and says, don't call Cobell, I'm thinking, yeah, that's right. You should freak out. But exactly. Please explain to her very gently what that would do, and don't just bounce.
She left her in her contacts. I thought that was interesting.
That's true. I mean, look, we're like two episodes from Ragabi leaning into Miss Cobell and going, Hail Hydra.
Right. So I guess, look, I love this show. For me, that scene didn't really make sense relative to what I know about these characters. And so sometimes when that happens, I ask, like, what don't I know about these characters to make better sense of this? Because otherwise the writing is fantastic on the show. But after watching the second time, I'm thinking, no, that scene was just very poorly written, because Devin is doing and saying things that she would not do and say. And Ragabi just is only ever frustrating.
I don't know, because people do not act rationally when they are panicking about a loved one dying. Like, they just don't.
At what and point I would you think, I'm going to call a con artist? My brother's well, in she trouble. I'm going to call a con artist.
She doesn't do it in the end, but we all go, like, who can I call to fix this when we're, like, grieving and we don't know what to do? Right. I think that we all kind of
if you think the alternative is that he's just going to die.
Right.
And there may be a person that knows something, that has a key to something or somewhere that can maybe help out. And even if it's not someone who you could trust up to this point, it's like, well, what are you going to do? Like, what are you?
Well, her plan is, which is not a bad plan. She's like, look, maybe we go to the birthing retreat.
Because she knows that that's a place where somebody can be inverted, right?
Walk in the front door. It'll be Mark's innie. We can ask him directly mm-hmm. what we need to know. Maybe that will do something. Maybe Cobell can get us in. So all of a sudden she's thinking, Cobell is our ally to try to sneak into the birthing center. It just makes no sense.
Well, she does also know Cobell was fired, so maybe she's like, maybe, you know, by luck she'll have, like, a vendetta against Lumen now.
Which is why Ragabi is so horrified at the thought, because she understands that Cobell is through and through a soldier for Kier.
Right. No, I agree with Ragabi on that point, for sure.
Yeah. And she's doing the big sister thing, right? She's freaking out. Mm-hmm. And then when she learns that Gemma's alive, like, wow, what a double whammy.
And Devin doesn't know Cobell that well. So Devin doesn't know how high up Cobell is and all that. I don't know.
Yeah.
Like, fair. Is she just a middle manager in charge of her brother's innie? I don't think she knows that.
Right.
She knows enough about Cobell to make that a very questionable decision to make the call. Mm.
I don't know what it's like to have someone teach you how to work with latching. So maybe there's a bond.
Once you've been kneaded a little bit by a person, you have a lifelong bond.
All right. Fair enough.
On that point, it's a slightly tangential, but it makes me think of this. I don't wonder if part of the reason why Devin and Rickon, you know, so they're starting their family. And I don't wonder in part of maybe some of Devin's motivations doesn't include making sure that Mark has the experience of being an uncle, because he never got to have the experience of being a father, which is just even more heartbreaking when you think about it. And then that look at the lunch table, like, it just tells you how much Devin loved Gemma, and how much she loves her brother.
Yeah.
Yeah, and maybe to Anthony's point too is that, like, because of what we had just witnessed in this episode, which is some masterful storytelling and use of very creative use of montage and kind of different media approaches, that when we get to the outside world, because all that is a whirlwind, and then we have this other dynamic happening between Ragabi and Devin, which is kind of a big dynamic, and then it just sort of crumbles with some I had probably less of an issue with the Cobell call than I did Ragabi just being like, oh no, if you're gonna call her then I'm out of here, okay, you know. And I just, like, it was such a, like, there was just no attempt. I mean, because even when Devin's like, okay, well then wait, you know, like, what am I supposed to do? And then she's just like, well, this is the decision you made. And it's like,
yeah, she didn't even call.
So it was a very odd that part. I don't even necessarily have a problem with the way that was represented, but I'm more curious about, like, why. Like, I feel like Ragabi's leaving for another reason.
Yeah.
And I wonder if it's like, you know, like, she needed to get out of there for whatever reason, and that was her way out. And
I mean, look, Ragabi's the kind of person who will straight up murder you with a baseball bat
from behind.
So this is how much she hates Lumen. And probably for great reason. Let's try a little bit of bedside manner next time, shall we?
Or maybe she just felt like, look, if anyone from Lumen comes in here and sees me, I'm gone. I'm done. So I can't even flirt with that idea.
When she killed what was his name, the security guy. That, I mean, that's an extreme response.
Grainer.
She didn't hesitate, and she swung to kill. She didn't let's knock this guy out and, you know, roll him down a cliff. Where she made sure that he was dead. So she has that much of a, her assessment of Lumen is that they are that dangerous that she has to respond in kind.
And self-preservation.
Right. Let me throw a different idea here. Could it be that Devin did dial Cobell's number? When Ragabi's about to leave, Devin hangs up. Ragabi thinks, well, she dialed.
Too late, yeah.
It's too late for me now. They've got the location. Even that little act of dialing and hanging up means that I've got to get out of here as fast as I possibly can.
Yeah, that's fair. Rabbit moves fast. You're not going to get away from it. We did have a couple stragglers on feedback. I just wanted to mention we had Ken W. write in right before we started to record, just to say, wow, smooth and good looking Mark. Didn't see that coming. And my weekly WTF. Then Alicia, some of you know her. I didn't play her voice today. She says, interesting that when Mark is comforting Gemma in the shower, the film starts running backward and you can see the water droplets rolling up. And then that transitions to Miss Casey on the severed floor to observe Helly. One of the few moments in this episode that made me start wondering if there might be something timey-wimey going on. Like, do you think that the memories are sort of out of order a little bit?
That's interesting. I had that question because I forget exactly what it was. There was something that seemed like that, this seems like maybe it was had to do with just hair or something. It seemed like, oh, that seemed like that was from a previous time or something, and I can't quite remember what it was. But so then that kind of led to maybe me thinking that there's two sets of memories going on at once, maybe. But Mm-hmm. But I think timing is an interesting factor, because I mean, it is important to kind of know how much time is going on. I mean, time is mentioned a little bit in terms of, like, you know, the how much she's experiencing and when she's experiencing Christmas. It's always Christmas. It's, you know, it's been 6 weeks, you know, I was just here. Like, I mean, obviously things we already know, but like, it feels like there was something drawing more attention to the timing and in this, like I said, with things that I noticed were time. And then like the blood, the theme was obviously something that was repeated a lot. And I think that those things are usually trying to call attention to something.
The real torture of the Christmas room is that they always have Wonderful Christmas Time by Paul McCartney playing.
Oh, man. Yeah. I would like to be severed from that song.
I love that song.
I actually like it, too. But I know it has a reputation for being, like, the worst Christmas song.
Well, my Christmases are going to be forever diminished because I don't think I'll ever get a de-grouter as a Christmas gift.
That's right.
I know. Imagine thinking you got a grouter and then you found out later it was a de-grouter. Like,
well, brutal. Brutal.
I was looking forward to all this grouting. Now I'm going to be undoing the grout.
Terrible.
Sarah loved the line, nothing says Christmas like grouting.
That's all I got for this episode. How about the rest of you?
We got a couple of needle drops. I already mentioned the one, the waltz with 1,000 beats. That is Jacques Brel. He's a Belgian singer-songwriter and that song is from 1959. And then we have an instrumental version of Baby, It's Cold Outside. And we have Billie Holiday singing
That's a nice touch, though, right? The Baby It's Cold Outside. Like,
yeah.
Yeah. Like, oh, I'd like to go. Nah, why don't you stay?
Yes, exactly. Right. It the lyrics of the song mirror nicely. And then we have the outro credit music is From the Cold by John Winterstein.
Well, we also have the second whistling of the
we do
Edmund Fitzgerald, right?
I forget about that. Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, and now we finally know who that was.
Yeah. And that, I guess, is supposed to you would think would time right, like the last time we saw him was going in.
Oh, right.
Was, mm-hmm. You know, so that at least would put us
connects the two episodes. Yeah, that's a good point. And again, they're just paying off these little mysteries, so they're not dragging them out too long. And so that feels like we're moving somewhere. So, but two more to go.
Two more to go.
Do we know anything about
three more to go? Isn't it?
Yeah, three more to go because there's 10 episodes this week.
Oh, do I know how to count? I obviously don't. Do we know anything about additional seasons, or are they just completely mum about that?
I thought I had heard three was a go.
Okay. I think you might be right. I think
Apple is not canceling this thing.
So, no, geez, no.
It's like their biggest show now that Ted Lasso is gone, or Ted Lasso is apparently coming back now.
Right.
But
you know what? Apple is so lucrative. It doesn't really matter how much money these shows make.
That's true.
Right.
You know, it's not like they have the Netflix problem. They have to monetize every single thing, or even the Disney problem. Like, Apple is just so wealthy; they don't need to advertise these shows. They don't necessarily need to keep them going. So I don't know. I think if Stiller and Erickson say this is a story we need to tell in three seasons, I think that's kind of what they'll do.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I will say Foundation, we know, was forced to reduce its budget. And right. So I don't know if Apple has raised its prices in the last year. So I do think that perhaps they are starting to scrutinize Apple TV a little bit more. Now that's been around a few years, but we'll see.
Only it's time possible. Will
tell. Yeah. Supposedly they're working on the script and they said that their intent is not to make us wait 3 years.
Well, let's hope. All right. Let's do quick programming notes. Properly, Howard, what are you up to?
Properly Howard is available for anyone to enjoy at their own leisure. We are between seasons right now. We've got great feedback for our Lost Boys episode. If you just want to dive into one of our more celebrated episodes, Lost Boys is always fantastic.
Do you recommend that people use their different innies to listen to different episodes?
Yes. make sure all of your personalities enjoy every episode.
Yeah, I would definitely sever maybe from the Death Wish one.
Anthony, I don't know if you made it through the last episode that where you were not with us, but one of your loyal listeners went back and pulled up all of your Properly Howard rankings and put them into a spreadsheet and sent them to me.
See, I feel like I'm trying to make the world a better place, and now I feel like I failed.
spreadsheets for days. All right, we got other people on the network too. We got Radioactive Ramblings covering Invincible. You may have heard a promo for that today, but you may not have because I don't know how the promos work sometimes. And
they're mysterious, but yet important.
That's right. They are mysterious and important. We've got Wool Shift Dust just finished Silo, and Alicia's going to have something cooking on Star Wars Canon Timeline podcast again soon. Never mind the music. Mark and Nicole, you may have heard them on our Supply Closet episodes if you're a subscriber or a season pass holder. They talk about music and psychology. I got to say, I was telling Alicia that something about Nevermind the Music has me listening to a lot more music again.
Like, agreed.
It has inspired me to take a look at my back catalog again. And I appreciate that.
Just one more note. Robbie Benson, who's introduced as Dr. Maurer. Mm-hmm. He's done a lot of work over the years, including directing, but our listeners may know him because he was the voice of the Beast in Disney's Beauty and the Beast.
Oh.
So that's a nice little parallel here. You know, we've got
to play the prince too.
A Beauty and the Beast in this episode.
Did he play the prince?
Yes, too, he did. That's right.
Okay. All right. So he might have a nice side. We don't know. David, do you have any?
Sure.
Well, we didn't talk about anything on the Lorehounds Network. Let's very quickly say Wheel of Time is coming.
Yep.
Alicia and I have already started our preseason coverage of that. We have screeners for the whole season, so we're going to be recording ahead. Andor's coming soon too. Where we're starting to make plans for that.
And Last of Us.
Yeah, but I can't look that far ahead yet.
Well, they're at the same time. Last of Us starts before. And I rewatched the first episode of The Last of Us last night. Man, that show.
It's a banger.
It's a banger.
All right, everyone. It's been fun. We'll see y'all for episode 8. This podcast is a joint production of The Lorehound and Properly Howard. Click the link tree in the show notes for links to more podcasts, our Discord server, and ways to support the show. Any opinions stated are ours personally and do not reflect the opinion of or belong to any employers or other entities.
Is it to Frank or to Beans?